The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. On February 12th, the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions held a hearing entitled Managing Pain During the Opioid Crisis. We're going to hear some audio from that hearing today. Witnesses appearing at this hearing included Cindy Steinberg, National Director of Policy and Advocacy for the U.S. Pain Foundation and Policy Council Chair for the Massachusetts Pain Initiative, Helena Gazelka, M.D., Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, where she's Director of the Mayo Clinic Inpatient Pain Service and Chair of the Mayo Clinic Opioid Stewardship Program, Andrew Koop, Ph.D., Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, and Anuradha Rao Patel, M.D., Lead Medical Director for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Let's go to the questioning from members of the committee. First up, Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington State.
You know, throughout this committee's bipartisan work on the opioid misuse crisis, I have heard from people who supported our legislative efforts, and we're very grateful. But I also heard from some people with disabilities who experienced pain and feared that restricting access to treatment could affect independent living merely because they were unable to manage their pain. So, Dr. Gazelka, maybe you can take this on. Have we struck the right balance in our work to reduce misuse, but also making sure that treatments are available, which can be really vital for people with disabilities?
Well, that's a very good question. And I worry that we've gotten ahead of ourselves with wanting to restrict opioids. A lot of providers are now scared to provide opioids to patients they've been prescribing them to for many years. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those patients have come in contact with a pain provider who can help them manage their pain, but with other means. Most opioids in the United States that are prescribed chronically are prescribed by primary care providers, many of them who don't have any education in managing chronic pain. They don't have time to go into the detail that it takes to talk to patients about other options. They don't have access to pain providers. And I think in some ways, we've done what needed to be done, which is to drastically reduce opioid prescribing, I think. But I worry that we're getting ahead of ourselves with having available other options.
Okay, thank you. I know people experience pain in a lot of different ways, but one of the things I'm really concerned about is how bias in the healthcare system can affect a patient's treatment for pain. Despite the fact that women experience pain at higher rates than men, they are more likely than men to receive sedatives or be diagnosed with a mental health condition when they seek treatment for pain. And when it comes to cardiac care, women are less likely to have their heart attack symptoms recognized or to receive painkillers after a cardiac surgery. And it's just, you know, when patients aren't listened to, the results can be debilitating, even fatal. So Dr. Gazelka, maybe I can ask you, have you seen female patients being treated differently than male patients?
I have a patient who has not only given me permission to share her story, but has encouraged me to do so. 60-year-old lady in 2017 went to her local provider in a small town in Minnesota with abdominal pain. She'd been very active running before this. As the year progressed, she was became less functional. Her primary care provider did not know what else to do for her other than ordering a CT scan of her abdomen and ruling out any difficulty there. She started presenting to the emergency room locally. After multiple presentations, the emergency room physician sat her down and said, "Mrs. B, you have chronic pain. You're going to need to go home and figure out how to manage this." She was frustrated, so came 2 hours to the Mayo Clinic emergency room and eventually ended up on my schedule in the pain clinic. Now, talking about bias, I admit that when I saw that on the schedule and I read her history, I just felt a little irritated that morning having to go into the room. But I stood outside of her room and I told myself, "You're going to listen to her like this is the first time she's told her story." And I went in and I listened to her. And I ordered an MRI that showed that she had a metastatic lung cancer eating through her rib and the nerve that innervated that area in her abdomen. had been present for at least a year and ignored because people felt that she was seeking opioids. Bias is a significant problem in all areas of medicine. It's a problem in research. It's a problem when we see patients. And it contributes significantly, I think, to the stigma that surrounds the treatment not only of chronic pain, but of addiction and of mental health disorders. I think it's a significant issue.
I'm not sure how we address that, but being aware of it is certainly a critical part of it.
I think awareness and I think education, both for patients and providers, the public as well.
And I understand people of color, same biases.
Yes, there are definitely studies that show that, yes.
Ms. Steinberg, I wanted to ask you, can you share your experience in providing a healthcare provider who helped you manage your pain and your thoughts on how Congress can help make sure that providers have the tools they need to support patients who live with pain?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I've often asked myself after 5 years, why did it take me so long to find somebody and what was special about this doctor that finally helped me? And it wasn't anything miraculous, and that's, I think, an important message today, which is he empathized with me, he believed me. A lot of people with pain don't get believed because it's an invisible disability. He said, I will work with you to help you find things to manage your pain, but understand that there is no cure now for chronic pain. You probably have chronic pain, and you're going to need to learn to live with this, but I will partner with you. He was honest. He was empathetic, as I said, and he worked with me to find things that help me. We often say in pain management now, if you do a program of several different things, and what I do is I take medication, I limit the amount of time I'm up. Everybody has different limitations on their activities with pain. I do a water-based therapy, physical therapy program and a land-based program. So if each thing takes down your pain 15 or 20%, it adds up to maybe a 50 or 60% reduction in pain, you can live that way. But it's a matter of having doctors have the time to do the coordinated care. Our system is so fragmented now that people go from doctor to doctor. Nothing is coordinated. They try one thing, it doesn't work. They go to another person because they're desperate. But if we had coordinated care, think about cardiac rehab. Heart disease has been a huge cost for us, right? But we focused on cardiac rehab and said, we are going to have a rehab program that puts everything together. And we've had great success with that. Pain needs something like that. We need that kind of approach where there's an integrated care center. Doctors have time to provide that care and you can try different things and have somebody helping you. You're not isolated. It would go a long way to saving a lot of the wasted cost from trying different procedures and different needles and different injections. And this is what happens to people with pain. So that's my suggestion. It is not miraculous. I think we can do this if we rethink and realign insurance reimbursement and think about models of care that are creative that way.
Thank you.
That was questioning by Senator Patty Murray during a hearing by the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee on the subject of managing pain during the opioid crisis. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear from the chair of the HELP Committee, Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee.
Let me go back to you, recognizing I've only got 5 minutes, Ms. Steinberg. We have 300,000 primary care doctors in the country. They're the access point for most of us to whatever else we need. How do we empower them to do a better job as you just described?
So that is a great question because I've been working in policy in Massachusetts for at least 11 years now. And I've worked with lawmakers to try some innovative things. And we just passed a law, something that I worked on, which was patients are being dropped from care right now. Excuse me. You've heard that doctors are afraid to take care of people with pain. And the bulk of people with pain end up, because we have so many millions, being taken care of by primary care physicians who don't get much training in it. So we
try to cut you off, but I've got several questions.
So we tried a program where primary care doctors can call pain management specialists for consultation free of charge to them. So the state is going to pay for specially trained teams of pain management specialists who can consult with the doctor, so the doctor feels more comfortable handling that patient, They have a network of alternative providers, and that really is helpful.
Dr. Gazelka, does the Mayo Clinic have such a system to connect with primary care doctors around Minnesota or other states?
We do have a system within our electronic medical record. We allow for e-consults where the physician or provider can contact a specialty physician and ask for advice to treat that patient and ask if a referral might be appropriate.
Dr. Koop, this hearing for an obvious reason, it's called human nature. You set out one direction, and it's the right direction, but you know for sure that something's going to happen that could cause in the other direction you didn't anticipate, and that's what we're worrying about here today. Let's say I have a loved one who's about to have a serious surgery. How do I think about opioid prescriptions in a state like Tennessee where the state has said, with our encouragement, 3 days per prescription? How should we think about opioids? Is this something you don't use at all? I noticed that Blue Cross in Tennessee won't reimburse OxyContin, although I don't think that may be true for other opioids. But how should one think about that, looking at it from the point of view of your own family and someone headed toward a painful surgery?
My own family takes opioids, and I'm fully supportive of them taking them. If somebody needs opioids, they should get them. I really don't think one of the issues is the pendulum has swung way too back to limiting and people suffering from pain. We need to get to the middle ground where opioids are used in limited quantities, but we also add all the other approaches that we've
had. What is a limited quantity? 3 days or 3 weeks?
I'm not a physician. I can't answer that. I'm sorry.
Dr. Gazelka, what's a limited quantity?
That varies by the patient and the procedure.
Well, what would a range be?
Between, I think 3 days is very reasonable for emergency room presentations. That's what we've instituted at Mayo and actually throughout the state of Minnesota with other healthcare organizations cooperating. But I think for a knee surgery, we know from research that it's about 16 days of opioid that a patient takes. Mm-hmm. What is appropriate is to educate the patient and perhaps with the participation of a pharmacist, educate the patient that you should take this for the shortest amount of time possible. The risk for maintaining long-term opioid use increases dramatically at about 10 days of use.
Dr. Koop, I have about a minute left. What are the most promising non-addictive painkiller treatments or medicines coming down the road? And you can mention your own.
My own would not be approved. My own would not be approved. It does indeed cause less dependence and tolerance, but it is reinforcing. So that's why I say the FDA needs to fully address all these drugs. My drug should not be approved. It would be the worst thing to put onto the market. I'm working on the next generation. The drugs that are coming, I mentioned cannabinoids. I really do. And I know that's a controversial topic, but there is great...
Why is it controversial?
Certain states have legalized. The federal government has not legalized. The studies out there, the studies out there have potential, but the studies have been done with no systematic approach. We need systematic approach.
So you're talking about medical marijuana?
Yeah, medical marijuana. Sorry, yes, medical marijuana.
We're laymen, most of us, women.
Sorry, I'm really sorry. Medical marijuana, yes. I think that has great potential.
Thank you very much.
That was questioning by Senator Lamar Alexander during a hearing by the Senate Help Committee on the subject of managing pain during the opioid crisis. The hearing witnesses were Cindy Steinberg, Helena Gazelka, M.D., Andrew Koop, Ph.D., and Anuradha Rao Patel, M.D. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Now, let's hear a round of questioning by Senator Bill Cassidy, M.D., Republican from Louisiana. It's worth noting, during her medical training, Dr. Rao Patel, who's one of the witnesses, was a resident under Dr. Cassidy.
Professor Cassidy.
thank you. If first, Ms. Steinberg, you're sitting back there, but I remember, and this will set up my next question, I remember having, when I was first year in Congress, having a slipped disc in my neck with a radiating pain down my ulnar distribution, and it was so incredibly painful. I was imprisoned by the pain, and all day long, I just waited for my every six-hour dose of Motrin and I staggered it with my Tylenol, taking something just when I went to bed. And for 3 or 4 months, that's all I did. And it just sapped my emotional energy. Now, I was eventually helped by epidural injections. Mm-hmm. And this sets up my next question, Dr. Gazelka. When I looked at the research on epidural, and for people who are not medicine, they put a needle right there, they injected it, and it would give me instant relief that would then wear away. I looked up the data. It said it was no good. The data says, you know, epidural has no long-term benefit in the management of chronic pain. But after my third one, it just went away and never came back. Now, then I looked up the CDC guidelines for management of chronic pain, and they say, going back to Senator Collins' question, that there's really just no evidence of use of opioids long-term versus no opioids versus et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems like we have a paucity of evidence, and that which empirically worked in me, you know, N is equal to 1, doesn't have the evidence to support it. Now, briefly comment on that, because then I'm going to go to my former student, Dr. Rao Patel, to ask if Blue Cross is covering things which have no evidence, but nonetheless empirically do work in some. So, quickly.
Well, so Dr. Cassidy, I do not have to explain to you that you can find studies almost to back up whatever you're looking to back up. You had acute pain. Epidurals very effectively manage acute pain, radicular pain. Probably for patients who have spinal stenosis or other types of chronic radicular pain, they may not be as effective. I could tell you that anecdotally from my practice. Do we use them? Yes, because they are helpful to them. Sometimes patients don't have other options available. Definitely for acute pain, those are helpful.
Now, of course, mine lasted 3 months.
Uh-huh.
Now, eventually, what my neurosurgeon friend told me is that just part of your nerve will die, although I still have a little bit of something, I tingles right there. And then after that death, that's a great way to look at it, I would feel better. So, by the way, I also once read in Mad Magazine as a kid, give me statistics and I can prove that Rhode Island is bigger than Texas. So,
that's right.
To your point. But Dr. Rao Patel, will Blue Cross pay for that which evidence suggests does not work? Number one. Number two, Dr. Gazelka mentioned all these wonderful things that can be used in lieu of opioids in the, say, post-surgical setting. But then my physician friends tell me, hey, you're on a bundled payment or you're on capitated payment, and the insurance company won't give you that bump up for the more expensive drug or the more expensive procedure. And I see Dr. Gazelka over there vigorously nodding her head yes. So tell us, since ultimately it comes to your decision as the UR manager for Blue Cross, how does that handle?
So along with her comment, there are studies that show that for acute pain, injections like epidural steroid injections work. Again, there are multiple kinds of injections for spinal pain, depending on where the pain generator is. And those are things that Blue Cross Blue Shield does cover. Several of the things that we've discussed, like physical therapy, occupational therapy, water therapy, chiropractic care, epidural steroid injections, facet injections, those are all a multitude of things that we cover as a plan without any type of prior authorization. So if a provider feels that this is the appropriate intervention for the pain, for the patient, for their pain, they can go ahead and do the procedure. They don't even have to contact us.
Now, let me ask, though, because clearly given a prescription for opioids would be cheaper than a whole panoply of that which might be less likely to induce. And it seems like that that's the rub, right? If you're getting X number of dollars to manage patients, how do you employ that which is significantly more expensive, even though long-term there is a benefit?
Well, I mean, our approach at Blue Cross is, you know, again, we've participated with multi-stakeholders at our state level, including the medical board and specialty societies on appropriate management and treatment of pain. And our approach has always been a multimodal approach.
So then let me ask, because I'm almost out of time, go back to the question of a bundled payment. And I don't know if Blue Cross uses bundled payment, but I can imagine someplace either you do or you plan to. And again, my pain management physicians say, listen, post-surgically, we can do this or that. But it's more expensive than just giving them a prescription or giving them an injection of an opioid. So how do we manage that? How do we approach as policymakers bundled payments when we know that it may increase the cost to do something which would decrease the use of opioids?
Again, the reason that we bundle payments, for example, is to be more cost efficient overall. So again, we're, not trying to limit the options that providers have in managing pain, but we're encouraging them to use a multimodal approach in terms of management.
But I'm not sure that answers my question. Because if your cost basis is just given a prescription for opioids, but the alternative is this, and he's lightly tapping his thing to tell me to shut up. That'll be a question for the record. Thank you.
Well, maybe you could provide some. Well, Senator Murray'd like to know the answer, so we'll give. If you, we'll extend the discussion for Senator Cassidy and ask you if you have any comment on what he just said.
Yeah. Again, like I said, the things that, for example, that I'm aware of that we bundle at Blue Cross in terms of payment are, for example, post-surgery. Let's say a patient has a knee replacement or a hip replacement. The perioperative period, the preoperative period, the perioperative period, and the postoperative period is bundled in a payment in terms of management of that patient. It's more of a payment question that I could get back to you on, and specifically what we bundle in terms of interventional pain management procedures. But there are instances where we do bundle payments in order to contain the cost.
Thank you, Dr. Cassidy. I think she said she wants to submit some homework to you. It's terrific to have a United States senator who has a former resident student as a witness.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in his clinic right now. So. Right.
That was questioning by Senator Bill Cassidy, MD, during a hearing of the Senate Help Committee on the subject of managing pain during the opioid crisis. Now, let's hear questioning by Senator Doug Jones, Democrat from Alabama.
Senator would be fine.
That's all right. Senator Jones you have a doctorate from law school.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member. Thank you all for being here today. One brief comment. I appreciate the comments about telehealth and telemedicine. We are continuing to have our rural hospitals and providers leave our rural area, and I've always thought that telemedicine and telehealth is one way to try to keep that. It is only, however, as good as our rural broadband and access to the internet, and that is something that my office are continuing to push for, and I would any help on that area to try to get broadband in those areas would be great. I do want to follow up, though, with an area, and a lot of times when we ask these questions, people think we're going at it with an agenda, and sometimes we are and sometimes we're not. This is not one of those. But Senator Rosen asked about the research and development using medical marijuana and cannabis. And Dr. Koop, you gave a very good answer. I appreciate that very much. But I'd also like to hear from the other three of you on this issue. I do think it's an important topic. It is one that in the public's mind is growing throughout the country. And so with each of our physicians, as well as Ms. Steinberg there, if you would, we'll just start with you, Ms. Steinberg, if you could comment on the pros and the cons of what you see in the developing of medical marijuana, cannabis, the ability to use as an alternative, but also the research that would be required to go into it.
Yes, and actually cannabis has helped a number of people living with pain. I mean, it's another option, as we talk about in the toolbox. It has helped a significant number of people, but it's not legal in a lot of places. And therefore, even where it is legal, as Dr. Koop said, it is not standardized. Doctors need to be the ones prescribing it, but they don't know what they're doing with it. They're not trained with it either. And so without having a real good research base, you know, we're just flying, you know, blind.
What prohibits the research base?
The fact that it's not legal.
Okay, just wanted to get that in the record.
Yep.
That we're a scheduled substance, so that it limits the amount of research considerably that can go on into both the pros and the cons of this. Yes. Okay, thank you, Dr. Gazelle.
I don't think we do know that marijuana is not addictive. I've certainly seen patients who have excessively used marijuana, not medical marijuana perhaps, but pot, and it is believed to be an addictive substance. And it is, not that many years ago, we heard that opioids weren't addictive. And so I think we have to proceed with caution, as with anything else. I think the inconsistency among the products that are produced with the ratio of CBD to THC, et cetera, is an important component of this that will factor in when it's being researched. But I think the impediment has been that it's a Schedule II, a Schedule I substance, and it's not permissibly prescribed by providers. But I do think that there may be some significant areas where this may be very useful. I have some palliative medicine patients using it for nausea, appetite, et cetera, and I think pain. I think it can be helpful.
Right. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
So I would agree with that. I think that there's, I think due to limitations such as the fact that it is illegal in some states as well as on a federal level, make research difficult. I think a lot of times I have seen patients of mine in the past who were taking opioids and, you know, if we did a urine drug screen on them, they tested positive for marijuana and they found that that seemed to help more than being prescribed an opioid or any type of adjunctive medicine to an opioid. So I do think that there potentially, from a physician standpoint, I think that there is some potential to the utility of medical marijuana for the management of chronic pain. I'll say, putting on my other hat as an insurer hat, that we obviously only cover procedures and drugs that are FDA approved. So we would obviously need some clinical evidence and support to be able to cover those kinds of medications.
Have any of you got any suggestions other than short of removing it off of Schedule One, which I guess you could do and put some other weird restrictions, I guess, what can we do? Is there anything other than that we can do to open up the ability to research the pros and the cons of medical use of cannabis? Or is that the impediment that we've got to try to figure out how to deal with? Dr. Koop, you?
I was going to punt this. I would say that this is a decision that the National Institute on Drug Abuse, that with the experts that could know all the confounding factors, it would be something that I think we should charge those guys with coming up with what is the best way forward.
Okay, great. Well, thank you all for your answers and thanks for being here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That was questioning by Senator Doug Jones, Democrat from Alabama, during a hearing of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the HELP Committee, on the subject of managing pain during the opioid crisis. In that hearing, the senators heard from Cindy Steinberg, National Director of Policy and Advocacy for the U.S. Pain Foundation and Policy Council Chair for the Massachusetts Pain Initiative, Helena Gazelka, MD, Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, Director of the Mayo Clinic Inpatient Pain Service, and Chair of the Mayo Clinic Opioid Stewardship Program, Andrew Koop, PhD, Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy, and Anuradha Rao Patel, MD, Lead Medical Director for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. There's no question that there's a role for cannabis medicine when it comes to pain management. The question which policymakers are wrestling with is whether marijuana should be available in its natural plant form as an over-the-counter herbal product, just like so many others on the grocery store and drugstore shelves, or solely as a precisely formulated and patented combination of cannabinoids produced by a pharmaceutical corporation and sold only by prescription. That question requires input from people with experience in cannabis medicine and cannabis research, experience no one on that panel really has. And for now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.